It could be that we leave something that we wrap up next week, but we are rock bottom central in this story. And as always, I want to thank Michael and Ruthie Mammon for dedicating the series for the year, and Sidney Wurzberger for dedicating this year for his father's yard site, Tzvi Ben Chaim Noach, Zichrono Levracha. Neshama should have an aliyah. So we've reached the point where the assembled Shvatim, the assembled tribes, in their third attempt, succeeded in demolishing Shevet Binyamin, not just the fighters, but the people in the cities as well. And they've run into trouble now because there are no women left for the 600 remaining fighters from Binyamin who are hiding out in the wilderness. And we don't want, they decide suddenly, we don't want Binyamin to disappear. That will be terrible. So we need to do something about it. And somebody has a bright idea, as we saw last time. We made an oath that anybody who didn't show up to fight would be killed. Well, we don't find any fighters from the city of Yavesh Gilad in Menashe, so let's get rid of Yavesh Gilad, the males, and then the women can go marry Binyamin. And they follow the rules of the war with Midian, we discussed last time, and they kill out all of the men, they kill out all of the women who have been with a man, and that leaves behind 400 women who are eligible to marry men from Binyamin. The problem is that at least one person in the assembled Shvatim was able to do math and realize that you have 400 women and 600 men, you're still short 200, and we need to maximize saving Shevet Binyamin, saving the tribe of Binyamin. So that's where we are in Perek Chaf Aleph, chapter 21, and we are at Pasuk Yud Gimel, sentence 13, and like I keep saying, it just gets worse. It doesn't get better.
Why did they have to kill out the, as if they were Canaanites? They were Jewish, right?
So they were, but they had violated that oath that we talked about last time, saying whoever doesn't show up is going to get killed. So they didn't show up, so they got killed.
But the women didn't violate the oath.
Right, so that was what we talked about. When we talked about the comparison with the war with Midian and the possibility that they drew an incorrect lesson from the war with Midian, possibly because the war with Midian was about an issue of immorality, and they said by not showing up, the people of Yavesh Gilad sided with the immoral people of Giv'ah. And therefore we're going to do to them what we did to Midian. That was one possible explanation. I would call it a justification, but I don't, can't really. It's not a justification. It's just an explanation for what they were doing. That was one possibility. Another possibility Abarbanel suggested was to do to them what was done to the people of Binyamin. You joined with them, so therefore we do this to you. Abarbanel had a couple of other explanations. They were just really angry because we suffered in battle and you guys escaped, so they just did this terrible thing to them. Or they were worried that Yavesh Gilad was going to hold themselves as better than everybody else because they were going to say, look, you guys, you know, almost eradicated a Shevet. You're the bad guys. We're the good guys. All of these are explanations that are offered for why they did this. But at the end of the day, none of them are justifications. This is just wrong. It is another wrong thing in a series of wrong things. So in Pasuk Yud Gimel, Vayishlechu kol ha'eda. The entire nation went. Why we emphasize everybody, I have no idea. But the entire nation sent emissaries. Vayidabru al b'nei Binyamin asher b'sela Rimon. They sent a message to Binyamin, who was hanging out, I mean, all 600 of them, in this place called Sela Rimon, that they had fled to after the battle. And vayikru'u lahem shalom. And they called peace to them, finally, at this stage. Vayashav Binyamin ba'es ha'hi. So Binyamin came back. Vayitnu lahem hanashim asher chiyu minishay Yavesh Gilad. They gave them the women who they had kept alive from Yavesh Gilad. V'lo matz'u lahem Cain. But they did not find Cain. So most people translate lo matz'u lahem Cain, and I assume this is what your translations do, that it wasn't an accurate match. The word Cain, like the word Nachon, right? It wasn't a match. I assume some of you have translations. How do they translate the end of Pasuk Yudalid?
But there
Oh, there were not sufficient of them. That's interesting. Okay. I would still end up saying it didn't match. The which translation are you working with there, Chuck?
The JPS from Safarian.
Got it. So the 1985 one. Okay.
And the Alhatora, I'm not sure what they used, but it's the same as Chuck's. The did not suffice them not. Suffice them not.
Okay. The Abarbanel has a... sorry, Ori, what do you have?
The same thing, suffice.
Okay, what edition are you working with?
Sansino.
Okay. Abarbanel has a different take. He takes the word Cain, the way we often think of it, as being correct, to be right. And if you look at source number one, he says, Pershom Afarshim Shlois Spikulam. The commentator said that, Miriam, like your translation said, Vikavanasi Beferusho. But I think what it means is, Shalomatz Ulaam Osam Habesulos Vlonasnu Osam Aleim Lefi Hadin. They didn't find these women and give them to Binyamin legally. It was actually wrong. Lo matzulahem kain, they didn't find women for Binyamin correctly. Ki im haisa shvoshi amisu kol asher lo yale al Hashem v'unusheim v'tavetapam v'chol asher lehem. Because if the oath really was, we're getting rid of everybody who didn't go to war. Ain't safik shahayu abesulos b'chlal ha-shvua. Like Moshe asked before, why did you spare them? Either you kill everybody, you don't kill everybody. But what is this business of killing everybody except for the besulos? Vizeu v'lo matzu lahem kain. That's the meaning of, they didn't find them kain, they didn't find them correctly. Kimo, just like when the daughters of Tzlafchad, and there's an irony in quoting them here, but I'll leave that for the moment, when the daughters of Tzlafchad complain about inheriting the land, so Hashem's response to Moshe is, Cain benos Tzlafchad dovros. They speak Cain. They speak accurately. Or Cain dibarta, right? Moshe says to Paro. Shulashon din umishpat. It's a statement of, this is right. That's the idea. Okay. So that's, either they didn't have enough, or it was wrong to do it, but they did it anyway. Either way, Pasuk Tesvav, sentence 15, V'ha'am nicham lebinyamin, ki asa Hashem peretz b'shivtei Yisrael. The nation feels bad. They feel bad about all of this, because Hashem has made a big gaping hole in Shivtei Yisrael, and once again, asa Hashem, we had nothing to do with it. It was God's fault that all this happened. We saw that idea before when they complained to Hashem and said, how could you have let this happen? The people are upset. Now, we already knew the people were upset, right? We said that back in sentence 6, that the people were upset. Vayinachamu b'nei Yisrael b'nyamin achiv, right? B'nei Yisrael were upset about what had happened to their brother Binyamin. So the Malbim suggests that in sentence 6, B'nai Yisrael is the leadership. In sentence 15, it's Ha'am. It's the nation as a whole. Which is an interesting idea, just because I would not have expected the term B'nai Yisrael to refer to the leadership. I would have thought that refers to the nation. But that's Malbim's suggestion for why we're saying this again. The other possibility for why we're saying again that they're upset is because we're about to start on their attempt to fill in the gap for the other 200, and therefore we reiterate that that the nation is upset. Everyone's following, right? I'm not going too fast with that. Okay. Vayomru ziknei ha'eda. So the elders, these are clearly elders, not the whole nation, said, Mana asela no sarim lenashim. What can we do to find women for the rest of them? Kinish medami binyamin isha, because Binyamin doesn't have any women left. Now, the next pasuk is extremely hard to render, which is why I gave you the table that I did in source number 2 on your sheet, to show you 4 different ways to explain this next sentence.
Or rather, Christina, can you drop the source sheet into the chat? Because my link took me to the old source sheet for some reason.
Did anybody else get the old one?
Yeah, awesome. I have the old source sheet.
Okay, so then what I did, I'm going to correct it now and ask you to just re-click that link in a moment. I must have made a mistake. You know what? Actually, I won't, because it's going to take longer that way. All right. Hang on. It'll take longer to do it that way. I'm just going to upload it straight. The way I do it's that I don't need a new link every week for the source sheet in the email, is that I just upload the file to my Google Drive using the same name, and therefore just replaces the old one. But either what I did was I forgot to upload it, or I forgot to resave it, and therefore when I re-uploaded, I was uploading the same thing. Either way, it's now up in the chat. Everyone sees it? Okay. Sorry about that. I'll just give everybody a moment to download it, because this table is kind of necessary for this. Sorry?
Where do you download? I'm looking at the screen, but I'm not sure how to download it.
If you click on the actual thing where it says 5780 sheet 53, do you see the chat? Okay.
Thank you.
Sure. Okay. So this sentence is extremely hard to translate. I'm going to ask those who have now acknowledged that they're using translations, if you could take a look, please, at your translation for sentence 17. Chuck, what do you have there from the JPS one that they're giving you?
Or they said they must be saving a remnant of Benjamin that a tribe may not be blotted out of Israel.
For they said that they must be saving a remnant of Benjamin.
There must be a saving remnant of Benjamin.
There must be a saving remnant. Okay, so what this sounds like is most likely this sounds like Rashi. That sounds most like Rashi's read. The way Rashi reads the sentence, if you take a look on your sheet at source number 5, the sentence itself, Vayomaru, and they said, Yerushas Pleita Levin Yamin. So the way Rashi reads it is the remaining remnant for Binyamin has to be saved. Nachlas Hashevet Nishara Rekanit. The portion, meaning the land, of Binyamin is empty. Havu Eitza Sheyolidu Banim. Let's find a way that they can produce kids. V'yachziku b'nachlasam ha-pleita ha-nish'eres. And that way, those who remain from the tribe will be able to take hold of their land. V'lo yimache shevet mi-Yisrael. And a tribe will not be lost from Israel. So what this is trying to do, what this is trying to say here, what Rashi's approach is offering here, is that the concern and the fear that they're expressed, that the elders expressed, is now being reiterated. The elders in sentence 16 said, Binyamin is being destroyed. And so Rashi says, what the sentence is saying is, yeah, Binyamin is being destroyed, and Yerushas Pleita means their land. Their land specifically has to be saved, and in order for that to happen, we need to do something. However, there's another issue here, and this is what Chuck is putting in the chat. The other issue is, it's not only a matter of, we need people of Binyamin to be able to hold the land. It's what's going to happen to Binyamin in the next generation. Because if they produce sons, the sons will get the land. But if they produce daughters, and the daughters marry somebody from another tribe, the land will leave the tribe. Now, that's normal, right? That can happen in an ordinary situation when a woman inherits land. You remember the discussion from the end of Sefer Bamidbar, where after the daughters of Tzlavchad established the inheritance of land, and this is why I said it was ironic, because we're coming around to the daughters of Tzlavchad and their issue. After the daughters of Tzlavchad inherit land, then their cousins in the tribe complain and say, if they get married to somebody and that person inherits the land, their sons inherit the land, the result is going to be that our tribe will lose the land. And the rule given was, don't worry, the rule is going to be that if a woman inherits land, she has to marry from within the Shevet. She has to marry a cousin. She has to marry somebody from within the tribe. But that was only for the first generation. that's not an ongoing rule. So the issue here is that you're talking about a tribe that numbers 400 marriages. They're now going to have, presumably, a certain percentage of them that will only produce daughters who are then going to inherit land, who are then going to marry out of the tribe, and you will lose large swaths of the land. That's the way Rashi understands the fear here. Are we clear? Yerushas pleita leBinyamin, the remnant and the inheritance of that remnant of Binyamin has to be preserved. If you look at the table at the third of my approaches, the Rashi one, the words Yerushas Pleita refer to the land, and the point is they are agreeing with the problem. They're not offering a solution. They're not saying don't worry about it. They're agreeing that there is a problem, and the message is Binyamin is going to lose their land when they produce daughters. Got it? That's the idea. But that's not everybody's read of this by a long shot. There are a bunch of different approaches. So, the Gemara in Bava Basra, Kuvta Zayin, it's source number 3, agrees with Rashi. I mean, Rashi agrees with the Gemara, but also says that Yerushas Pleita means the land. The issue is the land for Binyamin. However, the Gemara frames it as solving the problem, not stating the problem. So if you take a look at source number 3, the Gemara Bava Basra, Vayomru Yerushas Pleita leBinyamin v'lo yimacheh shevet miYisrael. They said, the Yerusha of the remnant is for Binyamin, and a tribe will not be eliminated from Israel. Amar Rabbi Yitzchak Devei Rabbi Ami. Rabbi Yitzchak from the yeshiva of Rabbi Ami said, Melamed shehisnu al shevet Binyamin, Shalotirash Bas Haben Imhaachin. They made a rule saying that the daughter of a son shall not inherit with the brothers. Meaning what the Gemara here is talking about is that in the event that there is a son, and that son then produces a daughter, that daughter will not inherit land with her uncles. Let me say it a little bit differently, because it's not the normal case of inheritance that we think of. The rule is this. Let's imagine a case in which a family produces 3 sons. Okay? Larry, Moe, and Curly. And Moe has a daughter. And then Moe passes away before the grandfather passed away. So now, the grandfather passes away, Larry is alive, Curly is alive, and Moe's daughter is alive. Letter of the law, Moe's daughter inherits whatever land her father would have inherited. That's the way it works. However, what the Gemara in Bava Basra says is they didn't just ask the question like Rashi said of, oh no, what's going to happen to this land when the daughters inherit it? They said the daughters aren't going to inherit it. In the event that Moe leaves behind a daughter, she is not going to inherit along with Larry and Curly. The land won't go to her. That's our solution. Chuck, you look perplexed.
No, I'm just thinking that they can't have made that, they basically deviated from the oral tradition they received from the Torah. And they also didn't state a sunset clause.
So it's not deviating from the oral tradition, it's deviating from a written tradition. Meaning the Torah itself says that the girl would inherit, that first of all, that a child of the deceased would inherit whatever the deceased would have inherited, and that a girl can do it. That's explicit in the Chumash.
It only underscores the difficulty.
Correct.
How are they doing this?
Right. As opposed to everything else they did.
No, but you would assume at this point they're trying to do this halachically.
Oh, don't assume that. You haven't seen what's coming next, then. They're not doing anything halachically.
The other thing I'm just wondering, did anyone suggest that they instead of going and attacking another group of Jews, that they instead go and force conversions?
Nope.
Like a group of Eshet Yefei Tor.
Right, so that does not get suggested. And it, I mean, from a halachic perspective, it would never be accepted. You're not allowed to force conversion, and Eishes Tifas Torah cannot be forced to convert either. The there's no, you know, there's no mechanism for that. We've discussed this before. I'm still waiting for you to respond to the proof, but no, there's no such thing as forcing an Eishes Tifas Torah. So those are two approaches. Rashi's approach is they're looking around and saying, yes, we have a problem because of where this land is going to get inherited. This is not yet the problem of what do we do for the other 200, right? Right now it's just a problem of what's going to happen to the land. The Gemara says it's what's going to happen to the land. Oh, here's our solution. Our solution is girls will not inherit, and therefore, lo yimachet shevet mi Yisrael, the tribe will not be lost. Mitzudat David, Rabbi David Altshuler, offers a different approach. He says they're denying that they have any problem. This is not about inheriting the land at all. This is not about that. This is simply about the marriage situation. So take a look at Mitzudat David in source number 4. Heishivu kol ha'edavi amro, the entire nation responded, Halo Yerushas ha'pleitam miyavesh gilad heim habsulos shechiyu, the Yerusha of the remnant from Yavesh Gilad, the girls they kept alive. Halo levinyamin nisanum, we gave them to Binyamin. V'lo yihyeh imkein od nimcha shevet, ki hem yolidu banim uvanos, the tribe won't be wiped out, don't worry about it, they're going to produce sons and daughters, and therefore we are done. We don't need to do anything else on their behalf. So in other words, the whole problem itself is different according to the Mitzudat David approach, right? Rashi and the Gemara in Bava Basra that I presented first said the problem is the land. What's going to be with the land when the daughters inherit? Mitzudat David says the problem that they're addressing is the problem of the other 200, and their answer is too bad. You know, like the song goes, 2 out of 3 ain't bad. That's the answer. 2 out of 3 members of Binyamin, surviving members of Binyamin, will get wives. That's the way it works. The other one?
Well, Binyamin lost all. What happened to all the land of the people that were killed in Binyamin? So, like,
that's
the people inherited all of Shevet Binyamin's land.
Yep, that's correct.
But they became very big landowners.
That's correct. But the thing is, it's not an advantage to be a big landowner if you can't manage the land.
Spread out. It wasn't to contiguous.
Well, it's all within the Shevet.
Yeah, but they were plots.
Who knows how they would actually assign this?
Is that the halacha, though, that when a family of a tribe is wiped out and other members of the tribe, the remaining of the tribe, inherits it?
Yeah, you just trace it back up the family tree.
Right, yeah.
It goes to their cousins, whoever survives.
Okay, so the 600 would have indeed inherited the rest of the tribe.
Correct.
Some of it would have gone out of the tribe.
It's staying in the tribe. So the other approach that I bring here is just Radak. Radak says also they're not talking about the question of the land. They're talking about the question of the 200 and the survival of the Shevet. And so Yerushas HaPleita means the survival. Take a look at source number 6. Tzarich Shetihye Yerushas Pleita LeVinyamin. There has to be a Yerusha of a remnant from Binyamin. V'lo yimachesh shevet mi Yisrael. We can't have a tribe be wiped out. V'tam Yerushas. When you use the word Yerushas, what it means is, who ki Yerushahu me Yaakov avinu liyos mi banav shnemas har shvatim ad olam. That there are always supposed to be 12 tribes. We talked about this before. Radak is of the belief that they're so upset because they say there have to be 12 tribes. That's not negotiable. So, and Rabag and Abarbanel are similar. So Radak says, the issue here is survival of Binyamin. And they're saying, yes, we have a problem. How is it that we can save them? So, I want to make sure that this is somewhat clear. I wouldn't go too far with it, but somewhat clear. In Pasuk Yud Zayin, again, in sentence 17, literally, it said, and they said, the Yerusha, which often means inheritance, of the remnant of Binyamin, and a tribe of Israel shall not be wiped out. Rashi, like the Gemara in Bava Basra, says, our issue is Yerusha, inheritance, literally. We're worried that the inheriting of this land will cause the tribe to be wiped out when it goes to males from other tribes. That's Rashi and the Gemara. Mitzudat David said what it's saying is, mission accomplished. We took care of the remnant of Binyamin. They're not going to be wiped out. We got 400. And Radak and others say what it's saying is, no, we have a problem because the remnant of Binyamin is not married off yet. We still have 200 others and we don't know what to do.
Okay. In the battle portion, they keep on asking God what to do. Even when it was to lose, you know, they ask God who should lead. They ask God, should we go back to battle the second time? They ask God the third time is, will we win? So there's no asking God here anything.
Yeah.
Like they're coming up with all these points you can point out the solution. And there's no asking God. They go to Beit El. They give Korbana.
Yeah.
But there's no questions here. Why?
I don't know. It's a good question. I mean, the easy answer is that when it comes to war, there is a well-established precedent of asking the Urim Betumim, getting guidance about what to do. We have in Chumash already guidance for how you go to war and what you're supposed to do and the conversations you're supposed to have, and you have a Kohen Meshruach Melchama and all of that. And so they follow the existing protocol. But outside of that established framework, they're just going to do whatever comes to mind. Ein Melech b'Yisrael, we have no king, we have no leadership. This seems like a good idea today. Okay, let's try it. And that's pretty much it.
Are they upset with God? Because in this portion, at least twice, they're blaming God for what happened.
Yeah.
Like their lack of asking, are they actually angry at God at this point?
Oh, that's an interesting thought. I hadn't thought about it that way. They don't express that other than to say, God, this is your fault, which, you know, you could argue is a statement of anger.
Yeah.
No, it's an interesting question. But no, they're not turning to God at all, because take a look at what happens in sentence 19. We're pretty clear this one isn't from God. Vayomaru, and they said, Hine Chag Hashem v'shilo miyamim yamima. We have an annual festival for God in Shiloh. Asher mitzvona leveit el mizracha hashemesh. You want to know where Shiloh is? Oh, north of Beit El, to the east, lemesila haolami Beit El Shechema, to the path that ascends from Beit El to Shechem. Actually, is it mizracha shemesh lemesila? Is it east of the path? Is that what they're saying? I'm not sure. How do your sentences translate it? Where do they break up the line? Is it east of the path? Or is it northeast of Beit El by the path?
It lies north of Beit El, east of the highway.
Ah, so it's east of the path. Okay. So, mitzvon le-Beit El, north of Beit El, mizrcha shemesh le-mesila ha-olami Beit El Shechema, east of the path, the route, the highway, whatever you want to call it, that runs from Beit El to Shechem, umi negev le-Levona, and south of Levona. So, very precise instructions here for how to get to this party that's going on, the celebration for Hashem in Shiloh. Vayitzavu es b'nei Binyamin le'mor, and they command Binyamin, saying, L'chu v'arav tem b'karamim. Go set up an ambush among the vineyards. Or isem, and you'll see, v'hineim yetzu b'nos Shiloh l'chu v'amecholos. If the daughters of Shiloh, and it doesn't mean if, it means when. When the daughters of Shiloh go out to dance, v'itzasem en ha'karamim, go from the vineyard at that point, come out of your ambush, v'chataftem lachem ish ishto mibnos Shiloh. And then you can go kidnap a wife from the daughters of Shiloh. V'alachtem eretz Binyamin, and quick, race back to Binyamin. V'haya ki yavo avosamo acheihem lariv eleinu. And when their fathers and their brothers get upset, and they come to fight, v'amarnu aleihem, so listen, we'll tell them, chanunu osam, be good to them, be gracious to Binyamin. Kilo lakachnu ish ishto b'milchama, kilo atem nisatem lahem, ka'ez te'eshamu. That phrase is a hard phrase to translate, that last bit. But what they seem to be saying to them is, Let me hold off because I have a lot to explain before I get there. But we have two different approaches to how to translate that sentence. But know that they're saying, tell the people of Binyamin, calm down. This is the people of from the festival in Shiloh, calm down. We just needed some wives for Binyamin. Don't worry about it. You didn't break any rules by letting them marry Binyamin because you didn't give them by choice. We took them.
And this is because their oath.
Yeah.
Forbade them.
Well, forbade them to give any of their daughters. So this way they didn't give them. The daughters were taken. This makes sense. This totally makes sense.
Yeah.
Like, of course they came up with this as a plan. They're the same people who brought you the slaughter of Binyamin. So this is another example of people trying to make the right move and it backfiring. But let's start from this set of instructions for how to get to Shiloh. Right? Isn't that a little odd? Shiloh's the Mishkan. Why doesn't Binyamin know where to find Shiloh? They live right there. So take a look at source number 7. Source number 7 I bring you just for the question value. We're going to have to come back to it, but I want to at least put in the question. I mentioned it or I alluded to it last week. Mishnah at the end of Tanis. Lo hayu yamim tovim li Yisrael kachamisha asar ba'av uchiyom ha-kipurim. The best days for Israel? The 15th of Av and Yom Kippur. Now, the Gemara then discusses the relative benefits of the two, but shebahen binos Yushalayim yotzos bechle lavan shi'ulin. On those days, the daughters of Jerusalem would go out in borrowed white clothing. And why was it borrowed? Shlola vayeshes misha einlo, so as not to embarrass anyone who didn't have. And there's a whole discussion about who lent to whom. Ubenos Yerushalayim yotzos v'chalos bakaramim. They would go dance in the vineyards. Umaha yuomros, and what would they say? Bachur, sanai necho re'ei ma taborer lucha. The young man. Pick up your eyes and see what you're choosing. Al titein einecha benoi, tein einecha b'mishpacha. Don't look for beauty, look for family, and so on. And each one would talk about their relative merits in order to lure young men. So the question has to be, what does that story from the Mishnah have to do with Pilegesh Begiva? You can't tell me that this is a random thing. A festival in Tanakh in Shiloh in which women get kidnapped as wives, and an annual festival going on in the Mishnah in Tanis, in which the women try to attract husbands. Something obviously is going on here. But seriously, if there is an event in Tanakh that I don't want to commemorate, it's this story. Why are you commemorating this? Right? I mean, can you think of another story in Tanakh that you'd want to commemorate less than Pilegesh Begiva?
I think
maybe the egg out. Yeah, but the Mishnah is describing a practice that's going on in their day.
Right.
Long after Pilegesh Begiva.
Before also.
Yeah.
The other people figured they're going to take advantage of the fact that the girls were doing this and kidnap them while they were, and take them for their wives instead of the boys looking at them and treating them nicely.
Maybe. Possible. I can't disprove it for sure. But I would have thought that would have been the last year they did it. I mean, it's just such a bizarre story. I mean, I'm translating the line of the Mishnah the way it's usually translated. I should note, there are some words there that may lend themselves to be read differently, whether cholot is really dancing or playing music and things like that. But basically, you have the sense of what's going on here. Because those were the ones who were there, I guess. Like, those were the ones who actually went out and did it.
But that's not to do with Binyamin, or...
No.
No.
So first of all, now let's look at the psukim, right? The instructions for how to get to Shiloh. Take a look at Radak in source number 8. He says, Vani Tama, I'm shocked. Matzarech lecholzeh, why do you need all these directions? Kishilo yadua hayabolo simanin. Shiloh was well known. You didn't need to give directions. V'anira be'enai ki achag haya b'shiloh. So he says, it appears to me the festival is in Shiloh. Ulahodia oso hamakom zachar ela simanim v'karmei Shiloh yismuchum lezeh hamakom. To inform where this is, they mention the identifiers, and the vineyards of Shiloh were near that site. So in other words, to let them know how to get to the vineyards of Shiloh. But I think that in order to really understand this, you look at Kaufman's line in source number 9, because I think he's dead on. He says, Mikdash Shiloh nasem mefursam besov tkufas ha-shoftim. He says, Shiloh becomes better known at the end of the period of the Shoftim, the time of Eli, the time of Shmuel. Aval ein zecher lepirsumo bereishis tkufas ha-shoftim. It wasn't publicized at all in the beginning of the era of the Shoftim. Remember, this story happens in the beginning, right? Taking that view that most of the commentators do, that this story happens in the beginning of the period of the Shoftim. Binyamin certainly is not hanging out there. Shiloh is only mentioned by name in Shoftim in the stories of Pesal Micha and Pilegesh B'Giv'ah. You don't find it mentioned other than that. We mentioned this already when we talked about Shiloh Asher Be'eretz Kanaan, that Elkanah, in the beginning of Sefer Shmuel, is trying to rally people to go to Shiloh. But this is part of the demonstration of how far the Jews have descended, that they're now in this position where nobody goes to Shiloh, and if you want to direct Binyamin to Shiloh, you better give them very precise instructions. North of here, east of there, south of there. Like, you're being very precise. In terms of the nature of this festival and what it was supposed to be, this miyamim yamima. So take a look at Radak in source number 10. He notes that when the text says miyamim yamima, the Targum, Yonasan Ben Uziel, says mimo'ed limo'ed, which could mean from appointed time to appointed time, like an annual thing. But he says, no, it's from holiday to holiday. V'amar bo, source number 10. V'amar bo atargum, mizman lizman, mimo'ed lemo'ed, ve'evshar kimi pesach lepesach hayezeh, o misukas lesukas, shayezman simcha, o biyom ha-kipurim shayu benos yisrael yotzos v'chalos bakramim kedivrei razal. This was when the women would go out and go dancing for shiduchim. In other words, what Radak thinks is what Moish said, right? That this is the same festival as was described in the Mishnah in Ta'anis. That the women were going out then, and that the women were looking for husbands, and now they found husbands. What Radak is doing is he makes this story marginally less horrific. Because at least they were there looking for husbands. Right? That's what he succeeded in doing. At least they were looking for husbands. Granted that, maybe they didn't expect it to be this way. They were thinking having a big wedding. They weren't thinking about being kidnapped. But they were looking for husbands. The problem I have with it is just the language in the text. If you look at... which pasuk is it? Yeah, Pasuk Chaf Aleph, sentence 21, the instruction is, Fachataftem lachem, grab them. There's nothing consensual about it. You know? There's nothing consensual about this. It really doesn't sound like it. And again, you could say, yeah, but it's in order to avoid the angry parents. Maybe that's the answer. But, yeah.
Still a stigma in marrying a Benjamite. And even if the girl acceded to the request voluntarily, the parents would have done it. I mean, I just have in mind the halacha, if you find your Bashir Dan Tisha B'Av, you're still supposed to ask her to marry you. Shema Yachifen, because someone else might seize the opportunity.
Right. Shema Yekadmenu Acher. Not, it's not this word. But you're right.
It's not the same word.
No, yekadmenu. To get there first. Yekedmenu Acher, and even it's a discussion whether it means that we'll get there first by asking her, or we'll get there first by davening, and Hashem will make her choose him. But, yeah. Yes. Like the Afikoman. Yeah. The answer, I think, really has to be that it's not just a matter of stigma, as Chuck suggests, but you can't do this with the willing participation of the parents, because the parents aren't allowed to go along with it. If they give the daughters, they violate the oath. So therefore, you have no choice. It has to be done that way. I think that's the answer. But I would suggest that maybe, instead of taking what Radak seems to be proposing, that it's the same festival, and that what they did was essentially then move a Yom Kippur festival and institute it on Tisha B'Av, on Tu B'Av, you could suggest that maybe this celebration that they did every year was instituted to redeem the event by doing it in a better framework and to celebrate the survival of Binyamin. Maybe. If you read the Gemara at the end of Tanis and they talk about the origins of Tu B'Av, you get a more full picture of what this could be. But maybe what they're trying to do is to redeem it by turning it into, it was a day when Binyamin was almost destroyed, and a day when, as a result of that, they kidnapped women for wives. We're now going to use this day as a shidduch day. But, without the kidnapping. It's a suggestion. It's the only thing I got. So if you have some way to improve on it, I'm very glad to hear. But I think it fits with the Gemara in Tanis about celebrating Tu B'Av and celebrating the salvation of Binyamin, and it fits I think it fits the picture. It's just, again, odd, because I don't see wanting to commemorate this story. I think that's the big hole. I also noted...
Why would the fathers and brothers be happy or satisfied with the situation what they did?
So that's coming in the next line. I mean, I'm up to Pasuk Chaf Beis in a moment, and then we'll see. But I just wanted to show you, if you take a look at sources 11 and 12, that there were parallels in Roman times, which of course is later than what we're talking about here. But in Greek times and in Roman times, if you look at Livius and you look at Herodotus, stories like this. Look at number 11. Rome was now strong enough to hold her own in war with any of the adjacent states. But owing to the want of women, a single generation was likely to see the end of her greatness, the end of Rome's greatness, since she had neither prospect of posterity at home nor the right of intermarriage with her neighbors. I don't know why Rome couldn't intermarry with her neighbors. I don't know what that was about. So on the advice of the Senate, Romulus sent envoys round among all the neighboring nations to solicit for the new people an alliance and the privilege of intermarrying. Nowhere did the embassy obtain a friendly hearing. In fact, men spurned at the same time that they feared both for themselves and their descendants that great power which was then growing up in their midst. No one will marry a Roman. This was a bitter insult to the young Romans, and the matter seemed certain to end in violence. Expressly to afford a fitting time and place for this, Romulus, concealing his resentment, made ready solemn games in honor of the equestrian Neptune, which he called Consualia. He then bade proclaim the spectacle to the surrounding peoples. Many people, for they were also eager to see the new city, gathered for the festival, especially those who lived nearest, the inhabitants of Canina, Crustumium, and Temne, I guess. The Sabaeans came with all their people, including their children and wives. They were hospitably entertained in every house. When they had looked at the site of the city, its walls, its numerous buildings, they marveled that Rome had so rapidly grown great. When the time came for the show and people's thoughts and eyes were busy with it, the preconcerted attack began. At a given signal, the young Romans darted this way and that to seize and carry off the maidens. In most cases, these were taken by the men in whose path they chanced to be. Some of exceptional beauty had been marked out for the chief senators and were carried off to their houses by plebeians to whom the office had been entrusted. So, kidnapping in order to make up for a shortfall of women. And you get a Greek story as well from Herodotus. So, this idea apparently was not one that we kept to ourselves. Apparently other people got it also. I don't think that makes us any better. But yeah, that happened. So what, yeah. Right, they didn't go outside the way that you see in the Roman story. Right, you're correct. Although, in the Roman story, they didn't have internal alternatives. It wasn't like this situation that we're describing where, you know, the tribes have sworn them off, but there are women. They didn't have women. So that would be cause for it to be different. But take a look at Pasuk Chaf Beis, sentence 22. We've got 11 minutes. Let's see if we can put paid to this story. The Vayaki Avo Avosam O Achehem Lariv Eleinu. Right? When their brothers come to fight with us, when their fathers come to fight with us, V'amarnu Alehem. So we are going to say to them, and now I'm reading it the way that Rashi reads it. This is the nation speaking, saying, this is what we're going to say to them. Chanunu Osam. Have mercy on them. We have had mercy on them, meaning the last 200 of Binyamin. Ki lo lakachnu ish ishto b'milchama, because we didn't get enough wives for the men in war. We fell short. We only got 400 for them from Yavesh Gilad. We didn't get another 200. Ki lo atem nitatem lahem ka'ez te'eshamu. And if you're worried that there's an oath, don't worry about the oath. You didn't give them. They were taken. That's Rashi's approach, that's Radak's approach, that's Ralbag's approach. So they're addressing two points. Number one, you're angry that we took your daughters for Binyamin? Feel bad for the people of Binyamin, you know? They need to be able to get married. And as far as the oath, don't worry about the oath, because you didn't do it by choice. That's Rashi, Radak, Ralbag. Dat Mikra, Professor Elitzur, has a different take. He says it's Binyamin speaking with their defense. And either what Binyamin is saying is, have mercy, because there weren't enough women from the war with Yavesh Gilad, and had you given them to us willingly, you'd be violating your oath, sort of a flip of what Rashi said. Or, we didn't take these women in war, and you couldn't give them to us willingly. So they're saying, look, it's not like we fought you and killed you for it. We just, you know, took them. But it could have been worse, is essentially Professor Elitzur's way to read what Binyamin would have been saying. Fundamentally, whether this was the rest of the tribes trying to smooth things over, or Binyamin offering their own justification, Pasuk Chaf Gimel Vayasu Chein B'nei Binyamin. Binyamin did it. Vayis'u Nashim L'misparam Min HaMacholos Asher Gazalu. They went out and got women from the dancers. Vayelchu vayeshuvu al nachal asam, they went home. Vayivnu es ha'arim, they built up their cities. Vayeshuvu vahem, and they dwelled there. Vayishalchu misham b'nei Yisrael b'eis ha'hi ish l'shivto u'l'mishpachto. And the Jews at that point said, okay, mission accomplished. And they all went home. Vayetzu misham ish l'nachal aso, and each one went to his portion. Mitzudat David adds, they each went to their own portion, meaning they no one took Binyamin's land. And we conclude, Bayamim Haheim Ein Melech B'Yisrael. As we've said a couple of times before, there was no king in Israel. Ish Hayashar Be'inav Ya'aseh. Each did what was right in his eyes. Interesting note on this. Mitzudat David actually takes this as a positive statement. Even though they didn't have a king, look how good they were. Take a look at source number 13. Im ki lo haya bayamim ahim melech b'Yisrael, granted there was no king then, v'chol achad asah hayashar b'einav, and each one did what was right in his eyes, mikol makom lo sholchu yad b'nachlas Binyamin, but look, they didn't take any of Binyamin's land. Aren't they good? That's the way Mitzudat David reads it. Whereas Abarbanel says, no, that's not what it's saying. Take a look at Abarbanel. V'kabanasi, what I mean here is, in these last stories, meaning Pesal Micha and Pilegesh Begiva, it said four times there was no king in Israel. Echad le'inyan Pesal Micha, once regarding Micha's idol, or whatever it was, the statue. Hasheni le'inyan b'nei Dan shahalchu lakachas Laisha. The second time with Dan when they went north to take Laish from the Tzidonim. Hashlishi le'inyan pilagish begivash nizkamtu b'nei Yisov v'nalchamu ela al ela. The third time was when the Jews decided to have a civil war after Pilegesh Begiva. Varaviza nizkar b'sofa sefer. And then the fourth one at the end of the book. Ubal inyan Yavesh Gilad, specifically related to Yavesh Gilad, Shechrimum v'nasnu b'desuloseim l'vnei v'nyamin, v'she ziknei ha'idah amru aleyem sheach tfu b'nos shiloh. The combination of, let's kill out Yavesh Gilad and give their wives, and then let's steal some more. Kol ze hayasiba lefi shaloh haya melech b'Yisrael. All this was because there was no king. Ki ilu hayasham, if there had been a king, lo nasim osama adrim ba'oso ofen habilti misudar, things would not have happened in this lawless manner. That is Abarbanel's valedictory comment on Sefer Shoftim. I think it's very fitting that we're not having a siyum. Because how do you make a siyum on this? It's just like, this story should just end. I feel bad because like those who have been here since the beginning of Shoftim, if I remember correctly, we started Shoftim in Ori's house, if I remember correctly, and it was after the summer, like a year and a half, something like a year and a half ago, that we started on Shoftim. And for a year and a half of learning, we should have a siyum, but like, this is not an inspirational story. It also raises certain questions, which we're going to have to address in the course of Shmuel. Like, you're really serious, Abarbanel, when you say that if you had a king, none of this would have happened? There's an awful lot of bad stuff that happened in the time of the kings. Right? We're told in the time of Menashe that Yerushalayim was filled with blood from end to end. We had kings who led the people into idolatry. Like, it's not as though having a king solved all our problems. So that's something we have to discuss. But I want to point you to the last page in the source sheet, the last sheet. I gave you just an outline of the book. Right? The overall themes were the ones we started with. Identifying God's hand in history, the fact that in Shoftim, everything comes from God. Whereas in, think of Esther, since it's Purim this week, everything that happens just sort of happens. In Shoftim, whether it's an enemy attacking or an enemy being driven back, it's always associated with God, bringing them and then defeating them. The idea that God can win with any pieces, it doesn't make a difference. He can work with anyone as his shofet. And the need for strong leadership to stop the nation from doing foolish things. Those are some of the key themes that we've seen. And then I went sort of chapter by chapter, you know, listing some of the major points. Obviously, it's 8:26. I'm not going to go through this all right now, but that was that's a little bit of a summary of where we've been and what we've seen.
Anything positive we can end with?
It's only up from here. I'll tell you something interesting because I have a Tuesday afternoon shiur where we're finishing up Megillas Esther, and the next one we're going to do is Megillas Rus. So I was reading an article this evening by Dr. Yael Ziegler, in which she talks about the view that Josephus has that Rus is actually part of Shoftim, and it sort of could be read as a bridge from Shoftim to Shmuel. And her point that she makes in the article is that that in order to have a melech who's going to be good, to have a king who's going to be good, the king has to be selfless. When you have kings who have their own interests first, you end up with disaster, because they have the power to pursue their own interests and run roughshod over everybody else's. So she sees Rus as the corrective for Sefer Shoftim, as the heroes of Rus are people who put somebody's interests before their own. Rus obviously looking after Naomi and really every step of the way, and Boaz choosing to marry Rus as well because he's ruining his portion financially and potentially in terms of marrying a Moabite, but he's willing to take her in at his own expense So that's what's needed in order to create a model for a successful monarchy. So that's a nice positive thing. If you don't like Kshoftim, read Rus. That's basically the answer.
I'm surprised you quoted her because you don't like her. You don't like her commentary at all in her book.
I didn't. No, there. I mean, there are some things that she's written that I disagree with, but I wouldn't.
She was talking about in her book all the time about how the ideal political motif was Shofet and not king. Right? Am I remembering that correctly?
I don't know. I have to go back and look, because I've read her articles. I haven't read the book. I've read her articles on the monarchy and on the weaknesses of the monarchy, and she points out certainly the ambivalence about monarchy, which we're going to have to discuss, God willing, when we get to chapter 8 in Shmuel. But I don't know what her conclusions are in the book. I just know the articles that I've read, which don't strike me as a wholehearted embrace of the Shofet. Yes. Ruth is credited, I believe, to Shmuel. So it's Shoftim.
Yeah. So he basically wrote it for that purpose, I guess.
Well, that's the argument, is that it's there as that bridge. Okay. More to be said. Yes,
Seder Olam, are these two stories included in there in a time frame, or are these timeless?
I don't remember. We'd have to take a look, which I can. I've got Seder Olam on the computer here. So let me just do a very fast look in Seder Olam to see whether I can find either one, because I don't remember the answer to your question. So, yes, they put it in the beginning.
They put it in the beginning, but they don't have an actual time frame yet.
So here's what I have. I'm reading in Seder Olam Perek Yud Beis. It talks about the elders who survived Yehoshua, and then Asniel ben Knaz 40 years, and they take out of the 40 years the 8 years that they are under Kushan Rishathaim, and they say that during that time was when Pesel Micha took place and was when Pilegesh Begiva took place. So it's when the Jews are under Kushan Rishathaim in that beginning period, because Asniel ben Knaz is the first Shofet. It's Seder Olam Perek Yud Beis.
Okay, so if that's the case, then he shouldn't. Okay, so he's putting it in that time frame, so it has a time, but they're under foreign rule at that time.
Yes.
And yet they're all able to raise up and do all this.
Yeah, because foreign rule, generally speaking, meant you pay us tribute and we could take whatever we want of yours.
But they all had swords.
At this stage, yes. When the Plishtim come along, we don't. The Plishtim confiscate the weapons. But at this stage, apparently we did. Why couldn't we fight off Kushan Rishathaim? You can give a lot of reasons that we've seen in Shoftim. Maybe we weren't united in that way. We're willing to unite against Binyamin. We weren't necessarily willing to unite in terms of fighting off Kushan Rishathaim. That could be one. All right. Well, thank you very much. I enjoyed Shoftim until we got to the descent, but looking forward to Shmuel. There's an awful lot of good learning for us to do in Sefer Shmuel. Be well. Purim Sameach. Freilichem Purim.